The Yesterday and Today podcast is a fan-made, not-for-profit, just-for-fun compilation of chronological source materials as they pertain to the Beatles. The show is in no way affiliated with AppleCorps, nor any organization connected to John, Paul, George, or Ringo in any way, though we do consider ourselves premier members of the Bungalow Bill fan club. So kick back, turn off your mind, relax, and download the stream. We hope you will enjoy the show.
Yesterday and Today.
The year is 1988, Episode 5, John Lennon Fever. This episode covers the months of August and September. In America, on August 22nd, the William Morrow and Company publishers published the book The Lives of John Lennon by Albert Goldman. The book receives immediate backlash from the public, the former Beatles, and John's family.
Paul McCartney.
I mean, the thing about those books for me is I kind of flick through them just to see what the first story I read is about. First thing I read in that was that John came around to my house and he was annoyed at me for something. So he kicked a hole in the painting that he'd done for me. Well, number one, he never did a painting for me, and certainly never kicked a hole in the painting that he never did for me. So right from there on, I think, well, this book is flawed, you know. No point in me reading it, really.
Anger and accusations against this book and author were so intense that Yoko Ono publicly fought back by doing a syndicated radio show response.
And now the Westwood One Radio Network presents a special report, The Lives of John Lennon, Fact or Fiction? Here's the host of our program, longtime radio and TV personality, Elliot Mintz.
As no doubt most of you are aware, there's a book out that's generating a major controversy in the media right now. It's entitled The Lives of John Lennon and was written by Albert Goldman, author of likewise controversial biographies of Lenny Bruce and Elvis Presley. The book's published by William Morrow, and excerpts have already appeared in People magazine here in the States and the Daily Mail in Great Britain. Since those excerpts appeared, Yoko has been besieged by inquiries from the international press as well as from outraged fans around the world. Their main question, is Goldman's account of Lennon's life fact or is it fiction? And if Goldman's charges are fiction, what are Yoko and the family going to do about it? The answer? This radio program. There's no way we could address them all, but during the next hour we're going to focus on some of Goldman's most controversial points through the eyes of those who knew John best. Now, right up front, let me state that this program does not pretend to be Meet the Press. And I'm not a man claiming to have a totally objective viewpoint on this subject. We'll leave the hard news approach to the folks at NBC and Mutual. I knew the people in this book. I had a personal relationship with John and Yoko that began in 1971, and have had a business relationship with Yoko since 1980, when I became her media rep. Now, John was certainly no angel, and never pretended to be. But the guy depicted in Albert Goldman's book is not the Lennon I knew, and I feel compelled to respond. Some will say that makes me less than an objective host. Well, like I said, this isn't Meet the Press, but I urge you to suspend judgment on those points until the end of the broadcast. Then, decide for yourself.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small. By I've given you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow the rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. Think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
For most readers, the most upsetting parts of Goldman's book center on John and Yoko's life at the Dakota between early 1976 and the end of 1979, the house husband years when they tried to stay out of the public eye. Albert Goldman's sources helped the author paint a picture of Lennon during that period as an anorexic, a Howard Hughes-type recluse, usually high on drugs. As for the anorexia issue, it's hardly a revelation that John was very self-conscious about his weight. It was a concern that dates all the way back to late 1964 and early 1965, in the year after the Beatles' phenomenal worldwide success. 15 years later, John spoke with David Sheff about that when they talked about John's song Help during their interviews for Playboy.
I was grossly overweight and needed help, and only one critic reviewer ever spotted it, and it was Al Aronowitz. And he wrote it in the New York Post or wherever he was writing it. Johnny, or whatever he was called, is crying out for help. And I didn't realize that I was at the time. I was just writing a song for the, I'd been commissioned to write a song for the movie. And I came out with Help. And Al Aronowitz's review of it said he's asked crying for help. I was crying for help. It was like, that was the fat Elvis period. You see the movie, he's very fat, very insecure, and completely lost of self.
On page 605 of his book, The Lives of John Lennon, Goldman writes, quote, "By 1978, John Lennon had ceased to resemble himself. Wasted by dieting, fasting, and self-induced vomiting, he weighed only 130 pounds. Totally innervated by lack of purpose and exercise, he rarely left his bed. Drugged all day on Thai stick, magic mushrooms, or heroin, he slept much of the time and spent his waking hours in a trance. Though he kept up the pretense of running the house and taking care of Sean, he was so zonked out that his presence in the apartment was hardly noticed. People who worked for the family would say, "Is there a real John Lennon?" End quote. I asked Yoko if that accurately described John in 1978, if he was really a zonked-out Howard Hughes figure living like a wealthy recluse at the Dakota.
Of course he wasn't. I mean, 1978, we traveled a lot, and there's a proof of all that as well.
But when John and Yoko and Sean weren't on the road in 78, when they were home at the Dakota, would the Lennons' employees, for instance, see John in the course of a day?
Well, sure, but I mean, if they were downstairs at the studio office, and I suspect that those employees were people who were working downstairs in the studio during the day, of course they wouldn't see John because John sometimes visited the office, but usually he would be working upstairs on his typewriter or with his guitar.
On page 15 of his book, this is how Albert Goldman describes Lennon a year later in late 1979. Quote, "As he slips out of bed now to perform his yoga limbering exercises, he displays the bag of bones body of an Indian fakir. His arms are not just skinny, but so devoid of muscle that when he picks up a hollow-body guitar, he complains of its weight. You could pour a cup of water into the hollows of his collarbones. He's pale, naturally, because he never goes out in the sun. But what is strange about his skin is the way it glows. This unnatural sheen is produced by bathing a dozen times a day and washing his face and hands twice as often. Shrinking from contact with either flesh or fabric, he rarely wears clothing apart from a pair of backless slippers. As a rule, he avoids touching anyone. If in a rare excess of parental affection, he takes Sean on his knee, John will make sure to seat the child facing away from him so the boy will not have the opportunity to plant a wet, smacky kiss on his father's face." End quote.
It's amazing that somebody took such a poetic license, or whatever you call it. I don't see John in there. Mm-hmm. But as literature, I mean, it's a very dramatically described something, but it's not about John. And I think I can safely say that because so many people have witnessed John going out of Dakota every day for a walk or to go to the local coffee shop to have a chat with the people there, or go to Seruti to buy some things for Sean. Or, I mean, he was very active.
People say I'm crazy, doing what I'm doing. They give me all kinds of warnings. Save me from ruin. When I say that I'm okay, well, they look at me kind of strange. But surely you're not happy now, you no longer play the game. Ah, people say I'm lazy, dreaming my life away. Well, they give me all kinds of advice designed to enlighten me. Tell them that I'm doing fine watching the shadows on the wall. Oh, don't you miss the big time, boy, you're no longer on the ball. I'm just sitting here making the wheels go round. No longer riding on the merry-go-round.
have to let it go. People asking questions, lost in confusion. Well, I tell them there's no problem, only solution. Well, they shake their heads and they look at me as if I've lost my mind. I tell them there's no hurry, I'm just sitting here doing time. I'm just sitting here watching the wheels spin round and round. I really love to watch them roll. No longer riding on the merry-go-round, I just have to let it go. I just have to let it go.
In 1974, after not seeing his dad for a few years, Julian spent time with John on the first of many visits between then and the late 1970s. After reading those paragraphs from the opening chapter of The Lives of John Lennon, I asked Julian if he'd ever witnessed his dad as the wasted character Goldman describes.
Did he appear to be of average weight? Did he appear to be less than average? Was he overweight? Was he skinny?
As far as I recall, average weight for his body height or size or whatever, you know. I wouldn't say he was fat or I wouldn't say he was thin, you know. The only way physically, I mean, by looking at him, he looked fine. And there were many times, because that last time that I saw him was on my birthday. And so we hugged a lot, you know. It meant a lot. And if Dad was the way Goldman suggested, then I would have crushed Dad quite a few times.
On page 688, Goldman writes that after John's murder, Yoko claims to have called John's son Julian, Aunt Mimi, and Paul McCartney to tell them of the tragedy, but that, quote, there's no evidence that any of them received such a call, end quote. Yoko says that a Dakota employee named Richard De Palma helped her make some of the calls. But with Julian, Yoko says,
I was on the phone, and Julian's then-stepfather, Mr. Twist, I think, was on the phone. And I said, please wake Julian up because I want to talk to him. And he said that Cynthia is away and that he would not do such a thing unless he asked Cynthia about it.
That's how Julian recalls it as well.
She didn't speak to me directly because I was asleep in bed.
You were staying at your mother's house.
I was staying at Mum's house, but Mum wasn't actually there. What happened was that the phone call was placed that my stepfather was the one that found out. He was the one that told me, but yes, she definitely did call the house.
And there are numerous other inaccuracies relating to Julian. So what does Julian think about all this?
I'd like for all of us to be put in a room and have some lie detector tests, or whatever it takes. And then we'll see who's telling the truth.
Next, I asked Julian about his mom's reaction to the Goldman biography.
I spoke to her a couple of times over the phone about the book. She's delved into it more than I have. But the more she reads, the more she just gets upset.
Cynthia Lennon spoke about the Goldman book earlier this month during an interview on the BBC program Woman's Hour.
It's made me more than angry, actually. And, you know, if I was prone to heart attacks, things like that, I think I might have had one, because I'm getting angrier and angrier by the minute. Albert Goldman is a vulture. He is picking the bones of people that cannot deny what he's saying, cannot stand up and be counted for themselves. Mr. Goldman leaves me speechless, to be perfectly honest.
I asked Julian how he remembers his dad and how he feels about Goldman's depiction.
I think he was a genius at his work and his lyrics because of his truth. And that's all he did talk about was the truth. And for someone to come along like Albert Goldman and create a story that is probably more about his own life than it is about Dad's life, and put it in a book and say that this was John Lennon's life or the lives of John Lennon is, for one, very upsetting, but most of all, crap, lies and untruths. And it's just upsetting that this man, especially after Dad is dead and cannot reply, thinks that he can sell something like this, get money for it, to live the rest of his life freely and do whatever the beep he wants. It's, the whole thing is just sickening.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of trick or dick. He's gonna mother hover top soap me. Just a pocket full of soap. Money for dough. Money for roll.
In an interview with the Dakota, I asked Sean about Goldman's description of Lennon as a drugged-out, anorexic Howard Hughes figure hiding out in his bedroom for 3 years.
I really doubt that anyone out there is going to really believe that my dad had the legs of, like, a bird, and he could pour water into his collarbones. So, I don't know, my comment on that is just that it's, you know, so outlandish and, like, blatant lying. Then it's so just stupid, you know? I mean, it's just stupid.
I read the part about Sean being seated on his father's lap in such a way that John could avoid a wet, smacky kiss from his son. Sean found that idea pretty unbelievable.
I've kissed him before. I'd sit on his lap all the time, any way I wanted to. I mean, that's just so stupid, you know, that he said that.
Now, talking about the item on page 606 about John screaming with fury, pitching the cat down the hall and kicking Sean in his pampered ass, Albert Goldman said
that John Lennon had a very, very short fuse. And I don't care how much he loved you or adored you or anything else. If you got in his way when he was having one of his temper tantrums, who knows what he'd do? Kick you in the ass or whack you around or anything else? I mean, because he was out of control at such moments.
I can't recollect my dad ever kicking me in the ass. The worst he's ever done to me that I can remember is yell at me. But kicking me in my pampered ass, I mean, I can't remember this at all. But maybe since Albert was... had all this quality time in the bedroom with my dad, I'm sure that he knows better than I do.
How about pitching the cat down the hall? Did Sean ever see anything like that?
No, I can't remember my dad throwing the cat down the hall ever. My dad loved the cat, actually.
Monster's gone, he's on the run, and your daddy's here. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Before you go to sleep, say a little prayer every day, in every way. It's getting better and better. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. It's a long way to go, a hard road to hoe. Yes, it's a long way to go, but in the meantime, before you cross the street, take my hand. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Before you go to sleep, say a little prayer. Every day, in every way, it's getting better and better. Beautiful, 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 beautiful boy. Darling, 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 darling Sean.
Albert Goldman.
I think he always was playing around with writing songs, but as I explain in the book, he felt that he had tunes in his head, but he didn't have any words that were worthy of the tunes. He was operating under a kind of psychic ban. The numbers, the stars weren't right. So it's my impression, as far as creativity goes, he was really lying fallow.
Well, what do you say to something like that? I mean, it's total fiction. Joan was always working. Joan was always trying to improve himself. Joan was always doing something. He was really never laid back. And his mind was always working, too. This is just not Joan.
As for the last few years of the house husband phase, there's a great deal of evidence that Lennon was creatively active. He was writing almost all the time, prose and poetry, entries in his journals, and listeners of the Lost Lennon Tapes radio series on this network have heard many examples of songs John wrote or began to write between 76 and 80. The many people quoted in Goldman's book, Yoko points out that
some of those people are calling in our friends to say that they didn't say those things. They're misrepresented. And a lot of people are standing up and now trying to speak out about it.
One of them is Abco Industries chief Alan B. Klein, who managed the Beatles as a group, then Lennon as a solo artist between 1969 and 1973. In a very rare interview, Klein spoke with NBC Radio's Bob Madigan last week in New York City.
On page 415, John and Yoko could not get out of bed until they had received their methadone, illegally prescribed by Dr. Zahm, who would add their doses to the prescription of another patient and Abco employee.
Dr. Zahm never issued prescriptions in the name of Abco employees in order to prescribe methadone for John Lennon for Yoko. I don't believe he ever did that to them directly or through anyone. The people in charge of the physician's record department at the New York State Medical Society indicate that Dr. Zalm died on February 1st, 1982. And he died with a clean record and his license still intact.
Come Together author John Wiener points out a number of other factual problems in Goldman's book.
Goldman reports that Lenin financed the riots at the Republican National Convention in Miami in 1972. He's referring here to anti-war protests that took place at the time that Nixon was renominated for president. Now, my research has included studying the FBI files on John Lennon. I probably know more about the FBI files on John Lennon than anybody else who isn't in the FBI. And there's nothing in those FBI files that said the FBI thought that Lennon financed the riots. And this was a time when the FBI was desperate to get material they could use against Lennon because the Nixon administration was trying to deport him from the United States at this time. So there is no evidence that Lennon financed the riots in 1972. And besides, it doesn't really make sense.
And what evidence does Goldman have to support his contention that Lennon was responsible for the deaths of two people?
What he's got is Marnie Hare and Fred Seaman say that Lennon said that he feared he had murdered two people. Now, Marnie Hare and Fred Seaman are the two most unreliable sources in the book, so to use them as evidence that Lennon murdered two people is ridiculous.
Now, how about the big controversy about Paul McCartney's January 1980 marijuana bust in Japan? The way Goldman tells it on pages 630 through 633, John and especially Yoko were responsible for tipping off Japanese customs authorities. Goldman says Sam Green said, quote, "She has a cousin over there who runs customs. One call from Yoko and Paul was finished," end quote. I asked Yoko if that were in any way true.
No, that's preposterous. My cousin who works in the customs, I don't have a cousin who works in the customs.
Professor Wiener.
Chet Flippo is the author of the new biography of McCartney. He calls that story a joke. He says that Fred Seaman tried to sell that story to him, and he refused to pay for it because he didn't think it was true. McCartney himself has said he doesn't believe Goldman's story. He called Goldman's book trash and urged fans to boycott it.
Last week, Paul McCartney talked about the Goldman book with NBC Today Show music correspondent Rona Elliott.
There's a bit about me where John's supposed to come around to my house and put his foot through a picture or something. Well, I mean, it never happened, you know. So if one of them never happened, it's quite possible a lot of the stuff in the book never happened. And I say, if he's homosexual, I would have thought he'd make a pass at me in 20 years, darling.
More disturbing than the McCartney question is what Goldman writes about the disposal of Lennon's body after his assassination, December 8, 1980. On page 690, it says that Lennon, quote, had a horror of cremation, a practice that he inveighed against and that he once proposed to protest in a song. Despite this aversion, his widow arranged to have his body cremated, end quote. Now, when I spoke with Yoko, I asked her if John had any aversion to cremation as far as she knew.
No, I don't think so. I remember once John saying this in an interview, and I don't remember which interview, but something to the effect that when he died, he would like to be cremated and the ashes to be sprinkled over an ocean.
Now, I have a copy of Lennon's last will and testament right here. It was provided to us by David Warmflash, an attorney for the Lennon estate. And nowhere in John's will is there any discussion of burial arrangements. This document, by the way, is a matter of public record.
I'll say this, that I have no apologies. I will not apologize to anyone about this book, except to Sean and Julian, that I could not stop this coming out. And also to the fans of John, who will be hurt by this book. These people in this book are not us. It's not John and me. And I'd like the fans to know that, so at least they would relax about it.
John, appropriately enough, has the last word on all this.
There is no line. The divisiveness of nationality and religion and public and private is almost the same, you know. Everybody's got something to hide, except for me and my mum. There is nothing to hide, really. I mean, what is the big secret? There is no big secret. The secret is there is no secret.
Another book that had been getting some attention is titled John Lennon, My Brother, by John's half-sister Julia Baird, along with Jeffrey Giuliano.
So now we go live to the television theater to meet the midweek guests of Wogan.
On September 2nd, Julia appears on BBC TV's Wogan with host Terry Wogan.
The man is everything from a drug addict to a mugger. Cruelty and homosexuality thrown in for good measure. Now, next week, another book comes out which may help to redress the balance. It's called John Lennon, My Brother, and it's written by John Lennon's sister, who we'll meet now, Julia Baird. So, you might be accused, perhaps, of jumping on the bandwagon. I mean, is this book brought out as an antidote to the Goldman book?
No, that's completely coincidental. Albert Goldman's book, as far as I know, has been coming out for 6 years. It's been in the offing. I was asked to interview for it 3 years ago, and again 2 years ago, and I refused. Yeah. So we all knew that it was on its way, but we didn't know when. And this book, mine, was supposed to be ready for publication in April, but it just didn't come off. So it's just coincidence, sheer coincidence that it's happened.
Well, now, to pursue the topic of the book, and perhaps by association, Goldman's book, why was John not raised by his mother?
Well, up until the age of five, he was mostly with my mother. And there were various family circumstances which just led him to live more permanently with Mimi.
That was Auntie Mimi?
Yes, with Mimi, yes.
There were all sorts of implications in the book, Goldman's, without implications, statements, that John was homosexual. Was there any... Had you seen any sign of that? Was that apparent?
Well, I mean, I was only young, but I would say John was a macho man. No indication of it at all, whatsoever, in the family. Paul says that he was with him in hotel rooms day and night, for locked up for long times, and there was never any sign of such a thing.
Now, when the Beatles took off, obviously the fame and fortune took John away from the family, basically. Mm-hmm. What was it, the fame that separated you? And was there any resentment in the family that you didn't perhaps see as much of him?
Not resentment. I think we feel regret that every road goes two ways. Mm. And John was... The separation came when he went to America and couldn't get the green card. If he came out, he couldn't get back. And he did. He invited me personally over and with the children any number of times. I just didn't go, and I do regret. I don't resent. I regret that I didn't go.
Did he change that you could notice, I mean, in his attitudes and his behaviour?
Publicly, he was John the Beatle, but privately, as I've tried to stress in the book, he was always John the Brother, and not just to Jackie and I, but to my cousin, and she's quoted the same sort of thing. He was just John. He was just John, never John Lennon, just John.
Did you, in all the phone calls, this was the period, according to the Goldman book, that he was cracking up badly and becoming anorexic and taking drugs. Mm. I mean, when you were talking to him on the phone up, on the phone most of the time. I mean, was there any indication that?
Not to
that
me.
There was anything wrong with him?
Not at all. I can only say that, as far as I knew, John was being the house husband, looking after Sean, giving him as much time as he possibly could, cooking, asking for recipes, baking bread, wanting medals for it, asking for how to make a better dough and how to make a good gravy, which I can't do. He could probably make a better one than me. I certainly couldn't see the bits that I've read of the Goldman book. I couldn't see it at all, and Paul agreed at all.
Was there anything in the Goldman book that you thought run true, that there was, or was it just, in your opinion, just purely sensationalism and erroneous?
I think I would agree with, I would say that it was trashy. I think there's an element of truth in anything that comes out, but how important it is, I don't know. I certainly didn't want to read, say, the Elvis Hatchet John. I think a man is known by his deeds, and it's what John put out that's important.
You were asked to help with the book.
Yes,
you,
I was.
Why did you decide not to?
Because I'd heard of the Goldman reputation, because I'd scanned the Elvis book and thought, no, I don't want any part of a book on my brother by this author. And I said no twice. In actual fact, he's acknowledged me in the back, and if no constitutes an interview, then I had one.
Yeah, but it's nice to have you here, hear you talk about it.
Thank you.
And good luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is meaningless, but I say it just to reach you, Julia, Julia, ocean child calls me, so I sing the song of love for Julia. Seashell eyes, windy smile calls me, so I sing the song of love for Julia.
Regardless of the controversy of the book, The Lives of John Lennon was selling. Various television and print media outlets all pursued an exclusive interview with the author, Albert Goldman, but only a small handful were able to.
Saturday, John Lennon. A controversial new biography claims he was violent, unstable, a junkie. Meet the author on West 57th, Saturday.
Goldman now was fully on defense.
John Lennon by Albert Goldman is at the top or near the top of the bestseller list just 3 weeks after publication. It's not so much a biography as it is a financial package, nurtured over 6 long years and pre-sold to the Literary Guild and People magazine. It's already provoked a firestorm of protest. Goldman, who is a former English professor, music critic, and author of biographies on Lenny Bruce and Elvis Presley, has granted only 2 television interviews about this book. You're about to see one of them. It was done last month, prior to publication, a few days after West 57th was allowed to read what America's most controversial biographer had done to the memory of John Lennon.
Look at me. Who am I supposed to be? Who am I supposed to be? Look at me. What am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to be? Look at me. Oh, my love. Oh, my love. Here I am. What am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? Here I am. What can I do for you? What can I do for you? Here I am. please look at me. Look at me, my love. Here I am. Oh, my love. Who am I? Nobody knows but me. Nobody knows but me.
John was a man who was a very violent person, a person who had fits of violence, the very, very agonized character, not a pretty character, someone who was in pain, someone who was suffering, someone who was angry, depressed. That's not a pretty picture, no. And was he generous? No. Was he loving? No. John Lennon wasn't that sort of person, no.
That Albert Goldman wrote an unflattering account of John Lennon's life was not unexpected. After all, it was from this typewriter that the world first learned of a 40-year-old, bloated, drug-ravaged, incontinent Elvis Presley clad in diapers. Heaven help you if Goldman does your biography, one author said, an appropriate warning since his subjects are invariably dead.
You are almost hard-pressed to find a single positive anecdote about John Lennon in the book.
It's a funny thing. I had the same problem with Elvis. People said to me, well, you're just giving us the bad. I said, boy, I would give anything to give you the good. It's just damn hard to find it.
Nothing good about John Lennon?
Well, of course, his talent, sure.
But Lennon's talent is not something Goldman chose to write about. In trying to take true measure of the mortal, Goldman has stripped away the very things about Lennon and the Beatles that changed the face of popular culture. The wit, the charm, and of course the music.
Well, what is there about the Beatles that you like?
They're gorgeous. They have beautiful. They got that certain something.
They've got that beautiful sound.
The sound. The sound. Good look.
Really, they try.
Oh, I want to kiss one of them. I'd love just to put my arms around them.
And here they are. The cries of the crowd grow with pitch and volume, drowning out the whine of the jet engine.
According to Albert Goldman, the John Lennon that came to America in 1964 was a coarse, violent street fighter who may have once actually killed a man. A smoldering hitter, Goldman calls him, who sometimes erupted into a terrifying werewolf. Within a year, Lennon would find fame a disappointing mountain, a view not worth the climb. Not even the drugs and orgies were much fun, according to Goldman. It was a trail that led eventually to despair.
All you need is love.
John Lennon, man of peace and love, is almost non-existent in Albert Goldman's book, appearing only as the public pose of a charlatan. Instead, Goldman's Lennon is a demented burnout case so cooked on acid that he believes from time to time he's the Messiah. And later, with Yoko Ono, a depraved, depressed heroin addict, a paranoid, anorexic, Howard Hughes-like recluse who ate with his fingers, walked around the apartment nude, being mean to the cat.
My book is a lot bigger in every dimension. In other words, I have the full length of his life. I have the full breadth, all the background, all the other people.
What about Paul McCartney? Did you talk to Paul McCartney?
Well, Paul said, well, I loved Albert's book on Lenny Bruce, but I didn't like what he did to Elvis, and I don't want to cooperate. So that was it.
And you didn't talk to Harrison or Ringo Starr?
No. Harrison's like a hermit. And Ringo's under contract to do his book.
And Yoko Ono?
Yoko Ono under contract, likewise.
It must be very difficult to do the definitive John Lennon book without talking to Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, or Yoko Ono.
You have to remember that sources are only as good as they are willing to be forthcoming and frank.
A lot of the stuff that's in the book were pretty well known. I mean, certainly Yoko, an awful lot has been written about Yoko's influence over John. There have been things written about his drug habit. Those are all incidents that have been mentioned in other books.
Perhaps, I don't know. I mean, what's your question?
Question is, what's really new about this book?
Well, you've asked me this question about six times now, and I've answered it six times, so that's the last time I'm answering it, okay?
Well, what I'm looking for is, what does this book bring to the table that wasn't on the table before, I suppose?
It's the kind of question that really doesn't have a succinct answer, okay? I mean, there's 71 chapters. There's new information each chapter. You want to go down the 71 chapters? You don't.
We did, and found a number of factual errors, reams about what Lennon might have done or might have been thinking, and material from other works used out of context to promote Goldman's dark and desperate portrait of Lennon.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It is not dying. It is not dying. Lay down all thoughts, surrender to the void. It is shining.
As the public sorts out the truth on John Lennon, Paul McCartney, meanwhile, can be found at Hog Hill Mill Studios in Rye, Sussex. We'll be right back. On September 5th on BBC Two, McCartney is seen on the show DEF 2, Animation Week. The show celebrates the world of animation, with Paul expressing his love for the art. Excerpts from Rupert and the Frog Song, Seaside Woman, Once Upon a Long Ago, and Yellow Submarine are shown.
Yes, all this week on DEF 2, it's Animation Week. Now, why they've got me presenting it, I don't know, because I know as much about cartoons as a jack of potato, but still, most of us grew up in the cinema watching cartoons, although these days animation is used for everything from adverts to pop videos. Britain is actually the centre now of a whole new generation of animators, and we'll be looking at a lot of their work this week, plus we'll be looking back over 80 years of animation. Now, we'll also be showing Yellow Submarine in three parts, and so to start the week off, we've got one of the stars of Yellow Submarine, although he's probably done a few other things since then, Paul McCartney, and he's going to talk to us and also introduce some of his favourite animation.
In the town where I was born, lived a man who sailed to sea, and he told us of his life in the land of submarines.
It seems quite incredible that it's actually 20 years since Yellow Submarine was made. How do you feel about that now?
Well, I think I like it now a bit more than I liked it at the time, actually, because the producers who King Features, the people who'd made Popeye, originally approached us to do one of these Saturday morning kids things for America with the Beatles cartoon series. And we said, well, we don't really want to do all the voices and stuff. They said, no, we'll just take your personality. So they came over and said, how's about doing a feature? And I said, wow, animation feature, yeah, you know, definitely. In fact, we kept calling it cartoon. They said, no, animation. They thought it denigrated it to call it cartoon, which we didn't.
Animation and cartoons as a child?
Yeah, I used to go with my mother down to a place in Liverpool called the Tatler, where they showed non-stop cartoons all day. It may have originally been while you were waiting for trains kind of thing. They were always nearly next to the big stations, and I used to just sit in there all day, you know. I love them. I always have loved them.
Over in London on September 7th, at Stefano's restaurant, Paul launches the start of Buddy Holly Week. Here he joins the Crickets on stage during a special luncheon kickoff for this 13th annual event.
London, living legends, these lads, is that right? Am I right?
And it's seen your tears a mile away when you left me on that lonely day. Well, at least by now you know the score. Every love match leaves the loser's sore.
Don't tell me that, don't tell me that, don't tell me that.
book that's on a movie doctor t-shirt.
With a new Lennon motion picture about to be released on September 30th in Hollywood, California, the memory of John Lennon is honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. The star is located near 1750 Vine Street. Describing the day's events, here is the Lennon's friend and confidant, Elliot Mintz.
Now, the day's events began with a multimedia press conference in Capitol Records' huge Studio A.
It's an incredible honor, and I'm very happy that a lot of people worked for it. I'm very thankful.
As Yoko notes, Lennon scored his own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame because several forces came together. Local radio, national radio, Capitol Records, Warner Brothers Pictures, the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce. But Yoko correctly credits John's fans for getting the ball rolling.
What happened was that this particular project was going on since last year. People getting in touch with me saying, how about this, and with writing letters, etc. And that was going on parallel to many of the things that were going on, like Lost Lennon tapes or this documentary film. And to me, it seems like another marvelous coincidence that it's happening now.
A reporter points out that John probably would have appreciated the Star Campaign's grassroots origins.
Yes, it's extra special that the people pushed it to let it happen. And yes, and that's a very important point. By the way, it might help this film, but I do know in all fairness, they weren't trying to control the situation or anything at all. It's a totally separate thing. And as you know, he was a working class hero. And part of the people, and he's got the power from the people back, and which is very, very special for me.
Yoko's asked what she thought John would think about joining the pantheon of Hollywood Walk of Famers.
John would have loved it. L.A. is a very special city for him. We had very beautiful times here together. I think we had two anniversaries here, too. He went to the Primal Therapy here, as you know. This is where he met Elvis. And, of course, everybody knows about his love for New York City, but it was a totally different feeling. When we come here, he liked the skyline, the palm trees, the beautiful sky that's always blue. And it was a very special moment whenever we came here. So I'm sure that he would have thought that this is a great honor.
Another reporter asks Yoko what she and John would be doing today if they were still together.
We were partners, and we were working together. And what happened was something that was sudden, and now I'm left alone. But if we were together now, we would still be working, exactly like I'm working now. So it's nothing unusual for me. And it's very important that John's spirit is something that we could share together, because he was good energy, and it will help a lot of people.
After the Studio A press conference wraps, Yoko exits stage left and makes her way up to the second floor of the Capitol Tower. There, on the rooftop garden patio, she's the guest of honor at a special reception attended by radio contest winners from all over America. While that's going on, Jim Ladd, host of Westwood One's broadcast, reporter Mike Reynolds, and the rest of the Westwood crew are out in the Capitol parking lot by Vine Street, setting the stage for the unveiling event. Take it, Jim.
Thank you, Elliot. This is a long-awaited moment for everyone who is a fan of John Lennon and his music, and they could not have picked a more symbolic location. Lennon's star will be placed one block north of what is perhaps the most famous intersection in all the world, the corner of Hollywood and Vine. John Lennon's star will join the Hollywood Walk of Fame on Vine Street in front of the Capitol Records building. The Capitol Records building is itself a Hollywood landmark. It was built to resemble a huge stack of records on a giant turntable. It was from this building that the Beatles would be released to America. It was from this very edifice that John Lennon's later solo work would also be distributed to the world. So it is fitting that here, in front of this symbol of the recording industry, that this monument to John Lennon will reside. John Lennon's star will be the 1,877th star to be added to the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Most importantly, however, in just a few moments, I will be joining Yoko Ono and go to the podium for an actual unveiling of the star.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is a privilege to present Miss Yoko Ono.
Thank you. I'm too emotional now, and I didn't expect such a beautiful, warm welcome at the time that the family is going through some trial and tribulations. Thank you. And I'd like to thank the LA people for allowing this to happen. And I would like to thank all my friends, John's friends, for making this to happen. John would have been thrilled, and he would have loved it. And this star, hopefully, will go on for many, many centuries to come, for people to come and touch John's spirit. Thank you very much. I love you.
And now we will dedicate the star.
Yoko is now moving toward the star. She's kneeling down with Johnny Grant and Elliot Mintz as they're about to unveil the star on Hollywood Boulevard. The photographers are all around. TV cameras are present. Bill Welch. And there they go. They're opening up the star now. And there it is. John Lennon's star, finally, in front of Capitol Records building on Hollywood Boulevard. It's a wonderful day for all of us here who are able to witness this wonderful event and a historic event. It's a long overdue tribute to John Lennon and his music and the love of all of his fans. If, as you could hear when Yoko gave her speech, she was quite emotional and quite tearful, which was kind of unusual for Yoko, but I think she was just overwhelmed at the outpouring of love and affection that has been shown here by everyone, because by now, I must tell you that these streets, Vine Street, is just packed with people.
No hell below us.
Continuing in a moment.
Nelson Wilberry releases a new album.
It's very up music. It's very, very up. It's danceable, if you like to dance.
Paul is back in the USSR.
I say we did 18 tracks, which came down to be the Russian album, and it did great over there.
And Ringo blacks out.
I knew somewhere in the haze that Barbara had been talking about rehab, so I said, you've just got to get us into one of those places.
And they really saved my life.
Next on Yesterday and Today.
Information or to contact the show, visit yesterdayandtodaypodcast.wordpress.com or email at yesterdayandtodaypodcast@gmail.com. Also visit at yesterdaypod on Twitter and search Yesterday and Today Podcast on Facebook. See you next time.
I'm Paul Kaminsky.
I'm James Kaminsky.
And I'm Wayne Kaminsky.
And we bring you the Kaminsky family of podcasts, Yesterday and Today, and the Third Men podcast.
You might know me from one of those dumb voices I do, or my dad from his better show than ours.
Wow.
And we're here to tell you about some cool merchandise you can pick up for the shows. As we mention in each episode, we do not in any way profit from these shows whatsoever, but to break even on some expenses, we have put up some cool merch that you can pick up to help support the show.
Yes, some fun apparel, things you can put on yourself.
Are we going to be selling Marks and Spence underwear?
Don't worry, we will.
You can head to our social media pages. That's facebook.com/yesterdayandtodaypodcast or facebook.com/thirdmen. Or you could head to society6.com/Kaminsky Family Podcast. That's society6.com/KAMINSKI Family Podcasts.
Yeah, keep our lights on. I'm in the dark.
Dad, any words of wisdom?
Hello? The lights just went out.
Guys, we need your help. Buy stuff. Perhaps a coffee mug that you can enjoy a beverage out of while listening to our shows.
And if you haven't got yours, please send forth in and get a free one.
All right. Thank you, Dad. All right, we'll see you on the podcast, folks.
Bye.
It's audio. You can't see me.
For God's sake.